Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are so excited to be sharing the recording from our Snacky Tunes Salon, our second live event hosted at the Chow Now headquarters in Culver City, and we hosted it on the Monday between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Happy New Year to everyone who's celebrating. And we brought in two of our favorite Jewish restaurants, Yangban and Friedman's. We had a great chat about how they respect the traditions of Jewish food and make it modern with their menu. We also talked about the rise in anti-Semitism and what it means to have a Jewish restaurant in this day and age. And they gave some advice for other people who want to take their own personal cultural experiences and turn it into their own restaurant and menu. Please note that we were dialing in the microphones at the top of the event. So if the audio sounds a little off for a little bit, that was just some technical issues, but it smoothed out pretty quickly. Big shout out to all of our sponsors, Livewire Cocktails, Ami Ami, and Skyduster Beer. It was a fun event, and we'll probably be doing more next year. But please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes Salon live here on Heritage Radio Network.
Surviving cold. me when you want me to.
Welcome, everyone, to Snacky Tunes. It's our second one. Happy New Year. Shana Tova to everyone celebrating. And it's great to see all of you coming out. Before we get started, I wanted to dedicate tonight to my grandma, who passed away this year. She was 96. She walked out of Auschwitz alongside my grandpa. And earlier this year, I was able to sit down with her and get her story on tape. So, since we're not celebrating her for the Magical High Holidays, our first time ever, tonight goes out to her, and if you follow me on Instagram, you can see a link to the story to hear about it, but she was an incredible woman. First off, thank you to Chris.
There he is.
Thank you so much. And Chow Now for hosting us, Livewire, Skyduster Beer, Ami Ami for sponsoring. And then to everyone who helped put this together, Aaron, Jackie, Megan, Adele, Oliver, Becca PR, Luther, who's been doing our artwork forever, and Josh from Friedman over there. He will be putting out black and white cookies. If you all behave, you can all get one. Tonight was really exciting when we talked about doing an event. Obviously, there's been a lot of conversation about Judaism and anti-Semitism and all this stuff in the world in the last few years, and I thought it'd be great to do an event. It's the Monday during the high holidays. Rosh Hashanah was this past weekend. Yom Kippur is coming up. And I couldn't think of three better guests than two of my favorite Jewish restaurants. We have Kat and John from Yangban, and we have Jonah from Friedman's and Greekman's, and I want to welcome you to the salon. Welcome. As much as I like to think that you're all here for us, we did post the menu, and there was brisket and salmon schmear and egg salad and matzah that was going to be served. And I know you probably came for as much as that as anything else. But I wanted to ask you guys, what do you love about Jewish food, and why do you think it plays such a big part in our culture?
I think there's something that feels sort of like intrinsically nostalgic about it. It's I don't know, it's comfort food, it's like sort of peasant food, like especially if we're talking Ashkenazi Jewish food versus Sephardic Jewish food. You know, it has humble origins, and it is intentionally sort of warming and nourishing because of, you know, the place that it comes from, right? And I think when I think about it, I think about family. And I think about the sort of like the kind of holidays that that bring people together when you have that food. Yeah. I think often stuff like the sort of like more extravagant, like brisket, and you know, you're not eating that daily, so you really do associate that with specific periods of time in your life, specific holidays, specific family members. And I think there's a certain, you know, like callback to those times that when you have that food.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. What about you guys? What do you love about the tradition of Jewish food and what it says about the culture?
So I didn't grow up culturally Jewish, but I grew up in the suburb of Chicago, Highland Park, Illinois, which is predominantly Jewish. Most of my friends growing up were Jewish as well. And for me, the parallels between growing up Korean and I think Jonah nailed it, it's the humility and kind of that struggle of making something great out of very few things. And I think that's a great parallel between what I grew up with my parents immigrating here in the 80s, definitely going through struggle to kind of get their footing. And I think that for me is the biggest parallel, and it's kind of intrinsic and very much kind of comes through in the food and the cuisine and the culture kind of surrounded around food as well.
Hello. So for me, I would say maybe childhood was a little complicated. I was adopted from Korea when I was only 3 months old. My dad is Jewish. My maiden name is Weiner. Odd. And my mom is Irish Catholic. And so growing up, without even knowing it really, I was always kind of in this odd place of identity. I knew I was Asian. I knew I looked different. But then on my mother's side, they were kind of like blue collar. We would have like Irish stew, a lot of pot roast, you know, Betty Crocker cookbook. But then on my dad's side, my Jewish side, my grandmother, she was like a single mother of two boys. And so that was challenging. She was also an English professor. So she was always correcting my English and the way I was speaking. But more importantly, I from her, yeah, it was comforting. Yeah. She would, you know, be boiling whole chickens and making matzo ball soup. And that's very different from like my mother's side, which is like Lipton onion soup mix and, you know, convenience, like TV dinners. But my Jewish side, my grandmother, she always was like putting a lot of care into it. Making latkes from scratch and, you know, grating them at our home and straightening them out. And then, you know, teaching us the importance of lighting the menorah and also reciting it properly and enunciating as an English professor. But she also, you know, she was very into the arts and she was an English teacher, and she took us to Broadway for the first time. My brother, he lives in Studio City. He's an actor. He lived with her the summers growing up and was in a theater program. So for me, when I think of Jewish food, when I think of these holidays, it's definitely a time of like comfort, of family. But also she just brought this amazing element of art, which I think is something that we try to incorporate in our lives. Art, creativity, pushing boundaries, and just doing whatever you can for your family.
Yeah, and I think family plays such a big part in this food and keeping that tradition alive. But, you know, you can't eat brisket every day, right? You can't have matzo ball soup every day. And there is this balance that you have perfected of keeping tradition and knowing that you're eating food with a certain point of view, certain background, but also evolving it because you're a restaurant, you're a business, and you want to bring people in and things like that. And I think of, you know, obviously the waffle latkes from Friedman's, and then like the matzo ball mandu from Yangban. So how do you balance what's tradition, what's familiar, but with making it new and your own? And what is the shift in, I think, restaurant culture and allowed you to do in the last few years that may have not been able possible in the last few years to balance that tradition and the new modern thinking?
I think when we started Friedman's, I noticed, you know, Sephardic Jewish food was really having kind of its moment, and its sort of like introduction into North America in a very, very big way. But at that time, Ashkenazi Jewish food hadn't really had that to the same extent. Like I saw a lot of, you know, nouveau and new school delis, but they were essentially making just like straight deli food with better ingredients.
Sure.
And that was
sure.
kind of it. It was like, let's source from a couple farms, but the food is the food. Like it's traditional recipes yeah. presented traditionally. And I think what I was interested in is looking at the kind of like essence of these flavors and the ideas that are presented in Ashkenazi cooking and, you know, making that a little bit more modern, a little bit more fun and a little bit more accessible and a little bit more like an actual dinner restaurant. Because I think also delis typically have had a, you know, at least in some parts of the world have had a difficult time like operating at night,
sure.
like as a proper dinner restaurant yeah. where you go and you, you know, you get a cocktail and you get a glass of wine and you have a proper night out. Rather than just like a big sandwich and a root beer. So I think that's sort of what I was interested in when we opened Friedman's, you know, is the question of like, why can't I have a kind of elevated Reuben and a martini at the same time in a
why can't
nice
we all
dining
have
room?
That? Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. And you guys, I remember you guys had the deli counter to start and your menus evolved. So what's that journey been for you?
It's been quite the journey. For us, I think it was taking what Korean Americanism is and kind of trying to flip it on its head. I think oftentimes these cultures get put in a box of how you eat or how you should cook. And for us, I think there is this somewhat of a renaissance coming of age of Asian Americans that are maybe sons or kids of grandkids or grandkids of immigrants or kids of immigrants. And we're able to kind of explore some of our upbringing while also being culturally raised American. Mm-hmm. So for us, it was really important to be authentic. And we often get asked, where is the Jewish influence coming from, right? And for us, as long as it feels like it is coming from the heart, it is coming from Kat's grandma's matzo ball recipe that's in our dumpling, those things feel right. And I think we're always searching for authenticity and kind of exploring those boundaries through that lens. And with that kind of exploration comes this kind of style of cuisine that we've been exploring for the last year and a half. And and a lot of that kind of is parallel with that search of identity and where we fit in and what feels right to be Korean American and what that means today.
Yeah.
For us too, you know, we spent 9 years working for Christopher Costow in the Napa Valley. He's Jewish. I don't think by any means does he, you know, intentionally try to make Jewish cuisine.
Sure.
He more cooks California, local, whatnot. But in working with him for 9 years, we kind of saw those elements where there were like little notes of being Jewish. And I think that was very inspirational to us and what we do, that it doesn't need to be so obvious. It doesn't need to be so blatant, but if it feels right, if it's something that makes sense to you, that you should absolutely incorporate it.
Yeah. I mean, you can see it in a lot of chefs who are Jewish, but maybe don't put Jewish food at the center. And with both the restaurants, that's a big part of your personality and what you talk about. And you know, look, we've all seen what's happening to a lot of Jewish people last year, the rise of anti-Semitism. And when you think about food through that lens as like political or standing for something, you are putting that at the forefront of your restaurants and a part of your story, especially when you talk to press or put out there. Why is that important to you instead of just saying like, it's going to be there, but we're not going to talk about it. You're saying like, no, this is something we stand for and it's a big thing that we represent.
I think for us, once again, I think that understanding that struggle with identity, with kind of finding your place in the world, I think Yangban was always rooted in community, was always rooted in service to the community. And that was kind of its core values before we opened the restaurant, before we even ideated anything else. We wanted to be, once again, coming from the three-star world, serving the 1%, serving people maybe once in their life, maybe seeing a few people every now and then, but trying to expand our reach, trying to be able to apply these things that we've learned through various kitchens and being able to make that more accessible to more people. Amplifying our cuisine, amplifying food for more guests, and making it feel not so exclusive as far as that skill set, because you often only find that skill set in the higher level of cooking, quote unquote.
Sure, sure. Jonah?
What was the question? About why you have Jewish food and identity at the forefront.
Well, it's a weird thing for me because I've abandoned the Jewish faith and I now have a Greek restaurant.
Sure.
So,
sure. But, that's fair.
But I put it at the forefront, I think, because I was interested in exploring that kind of food. And I think I wanted to, it felt authentic. And to present to present sort of like Jewish American experience, because I think, aesthetically, in addition, I think the whole dining experience at Friedman's to me felt like authentically Jewish American, at least that's what I was pulling from. And I think that just felt like familiar and fun, and it wasn't something that I necessarily had like seen a lot of, and I think that representation was something I was interested in exploring. Like, I think even now there's like, I'm trying to think of like how many restaurants I can name that are really like authentically Jewish American in that
Kibitz
way.
Kibitz Room,
yeah.
Yeah, it's about it.
Yeah. Kachka.
Yeah, Kachka.
Right.
Shout out to Bonnie.
Yeah.
Love Kachka. You talk about your core values, and you just talked about your evolution to Friedman's to Greekman's, and Yongbon, if you haven't seen it this last week, they just debuted their new design, which is gorgeous both in aesthetic and menu. But walking back into the restaurants, even after all the changes, you still feel the core value of it. In evolving, in redefining the restaurant as it faces outwards, what did you want to hold on to, and what did you want to evolve?
I think, again, we come from a background of providing a very curated experience. And I think classically we're trained to put together like all of your best qualities and show them to everyone every night. But I think for Yongbon, it was really important for us to just be ourselves and put that out there. And knowing that that would take work, and knowing that along the way there would probably be edits that need to be made and evolution and growth. And so in this iteration of Yongbon, and I say this sincerely, this sounds like a PR stunt. Sincerely, I think we're the most excited about this chapter. Mm. I know with the deli, I still feel like we're going to come around to the deli again, hopefully, in a few years, Korean-American deli. But I do also think that was like a reaction to us really wanting to like be here for the community and get rid of some of the smoke and mirrors and remove some of the things that jack up the price and be humble. But I also think that was us saying like, I don't know who we didn't know who we were.
Sure, sure.
We spent 9 years, mentoring under someone and doing, helping them with their vision. So in this process, while we have opened 3 times in a year and a half, this final one feels great because, there was a part of us that I think missed a little bit of that background. Mm. And some of that show and some of that intensity and some of that like attention to detail. So for us to get to reopen, still be doing food that is authentically ours. It's Korean, it's American, it's Jewish in some ways. And do it in a room that I think we're really proud of and present it in a new way that I think will reach more people. I mean, I think we're excited about this chapter.
Yeah. And what about the Greekman's chapter, which is delicious on its own right, but still feels like you're walking into the old Friedman's?
I mean, because, I think in part we did, a $5,000 paint job, and that was, that was the extent of it. But I think, to, like, It's a restaurant that is a neighborhood restaurant, and it always was, and that was the intention from the beginning. It's, you know, the kind of like awards were great, but that wasn't the point. The point was to, you know, hunker down in like this sort of Silver Lake Echo Park border and to feed, you know, the community in that way. I think we've always tried to like keep our price point relatively accessible and have like a relatively like, you know, laid back approach, but hopefully relatively attentive, you know, style of service. I feel like in some ways it was just a response to, you know, me like coming from wherever I was coming from at that point and touching down in Silver Lake and figuring that like this is sort of the vibe and atmosphere, and this is kind of the restaurant that I thought that neighborhood wanted and needed. And it's also the restaurant I kind of wanted to open. Yeah. So, you know, it felt like, I guess, natural and authentic in that way. And I think that's what we've tried to grab onto is how do we still try to have these like very human experiences at tables, right? Like, I don't want our servers to be robots. I want them to be themselves. And I want that experience to feel that, like, I want you to feel like there's a sense of community when you're walking into the restaurant. And I hope that that continues to translate.
I mean, I think the great thing about both the places, other than being able to have the longevity to evolve and change, is that you are serving community. Like, you are neighborhood restaurants, but then you're also telling your story. And I think that that is where a lot of restaurants are headed now, is that places that serve the community, you both have awards at a national level, which are great, but we all know that that does not mean you get to stay open for 5-10 years. We've seen a lot of things win awards and then unfortunately go away. So for people who are thinking about opening up a neighborhood spot or opening a place in the community, but also tells the personal story through heritage or point of view, what advice would you give, both in being kind to themselves and being allowing themselves the freedom to make the food they want, not being so stuck in tradition, but still having a nod to where they come from?
Run a lean labor model.
I would say it's a delicate balance because, you know, you hear a lot of these restaurants being so deeply personal, so deeply about these stories, and we want all this to convey through the food and the style of service. But for me, the realization of being closed for a little bit, the 30 days we were remodeling, and being able to be a normal human being and eat dinner at a normal time with your family, it puts things into perspective as to why people go out to restaurants to celebrate, to hang out, to catch up, to break bread with family. And sometimes as a chef, you lose sight of that. You lose sight of that part of what is special about restaurants and why restaurants will continue to exist. So for me, the balance is do what kind of gives you purpose, but also keep in mind that we're here to feed, we're here to be that forum for families to unite, for friends to celebrate birthdays, anniversaries. And that, for me, has been, I guess, the biggest inspiration to why Yangban 2.0 is going to kind of go more into that experience and explore what that experience is for everyone else, because everyone is there for a reason. And that was kind of inspiring to me as far as the exploration.
I think that's a great answer. I think he's totally right. I think, you know, generally I would say it seems to me that like restaurant trends are headed either into like hyper experiential or into fast casual. And the sort of like middle zone is really getting screwed right now. And I think, you know, dining is more expensive than ever. And so understanding that when people are going out, like they're spending, you know, precious dollars, and they want a great experience. They are going out to celebrate in that way, and they're going out to be with friends. And I think kind of rising to that occasion is a very smart thing.
Yeah. Now, listen, speaking of celebration, it's the Jewish New Year. There's going to be a long day of fasting, celebrate a break fast. And I always think about this time as like getting together with the family, and celebrating. So I'd like to ask, how do you break your fast? And what's on the playlist for this celebratory time of year? Playlist?
Playlist or platelist?
Playlist. I mean, I guess both. I guess your platelist for breakfast and your playlist for the stereo.
I mean, I think your life becomes a rat. We listen to the Yangban playlist. We make them still, and I. But it goes all over the place. I mean, I guess if I had to pick just one, it's 90s R&B or hip-hop. But we try to stay current as well. So I make sure, because we have some young guests, so I make sure I'm always listening to whatever's new, even if I don't like it, because I think it's important creatively to stay on top of things. And my grandmother did that. She embraced like new ideas, and she always was hosting dinners at her house with her young like English students, and they would cook. And so she was always one of those older people of the community who really enjoyed being with younger members. I'm not so much. I'm cranky, so I force myself to listen to playlists. But yeah, 90s hip hop.
As far as how we break our fast, we probably do like a traditional Korean brisket soup or something. Ooh. Like that. That's very parallel as well. That's probably our move.
Yeah. Jonah?
I feel like I'm breaking the fast feels like something I did when I was like still in living with my parents. I'm culturally Jewish, but not religiously. Sure. I don't even think I actually fast on Yom Kippur anymore.
You know, you could say Ruggala and we could just move on.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think just any kind of nice, any time to sort of slow down and reflect and spend the day cooking feels like a good, you know, sort of version of that, of breaking the fast. Yeah. Jewish appetizing food, always the way to go. Yeah.
So as we start to wrap this up, and you bring up a good word about reflection, because that's really what we do this time of year. When people come in and dine with you and they sit at their table and you've hosted them and they've enjoyed your libations and your courses and the music and the atmosphere and the great service, what do you want people to walk away with? What do you want them to think about when they leave and walk out those doors?
I think at Yangban, we hope that everyone can find like a little something to identify with, even if it's subtle. Whether it's in the food or the service or an element of design, just something that you can identify with, where it makes you feel comfortable, reminds you of something familiar, yet is presented in a different way, and then makes you question that a little bit, or makes you think about it a little differently. That's always been the goal.
Yeah, I think just being able to go with it, like leave a meal, and be able to question a little bit about yourself. I think we all come from somewhere, and that somewhere is very different for all of us. And be able to kind of reflect upon that and kind of sit in that area a little bit and kind of let that soak in. I don't know.
Yeah. That's what it's at.
I don't know. I think at this point, I just hope people have a good time. I hope that it was, you know, sort of like conducive to the evening in whatever way it needed to be, whether that was some sort of reunion or celebration. You know, I hope that we could sort of be of service in that way. And then I hope they think, you know, when are they coming back?
Yeah, exactly. Support your neighborhood restaurant. Yeah. Well, thank you all. Thank you for coming out, for doing what you do. If you haven't been to the new Yangban, swing in. If you haven't been to Greekman's, swing in. We have black and white cookies because you all behaved very well. And there's some drinks left. And thank you again to Chris and Chow Now and everyone. And Happy New Year.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state.
Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Ben Cherkin live in studio.
How's it going?
Good.
Let's see.
I'm Ian White. I'm the hired gun.
Oh, hey, hired gun.
Hi.
Bass player.
Bass player.
Bass and guitar.
Bass and guitar.
Yeah.
Ben, you were raised as a jazz guitarist.
Yeah.
What is it that...
In a way.
Well, in what way? And also, how does that differ from just regular guitar? And why did you lean that way as a young kid?
So, in high school, we actually played in the jazz band together. We went to high school together. And I would say, you know, it was mostly structured as you're reading music, you're soloing. It's a little more free form. But at the same time, there's more like music theory applied to it, which I'm not like the biggest fan of. I would honestly consider Ian like a way better guitarist than I am. I'm not trying to flatter him.
I'd agree with that.
But, it's just like different from the music I'm making now. I still apply like sort of the same chord structures and, a lot of like major sevenths and minor sevenths that like find its way into my music now because of it.
How does it get brought in, or where do you think that it elevates your current music to something that's like so theoretical? I mean, dance, I don't want to say you're making dance music, but it's very forward to the floor, very, you know, straightforward. How does the jazz weave its way into the composition?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. Really the structure of jazz tunes in a way are not like a pop structure where you have like verse chorus, and I think that has really like influenced my music in a way where I'm not trying to structure it like a pop song. I'll sort of weave into like new sections after another and not really think about, okay, this needs to be a bridge and then a chorus. It's sort of like melody, it becomes important, and that's like one of the most important parts, and sort of veering away from any sort of like normal structure in that way, that mindset.
Yeah. And you were born and raised in LA.
Yeah.
And you you DJed a bunch of parties, house parties,
yeah,
clubs.
Yeah, that's how I started.
Where would you DJ and how would you get in?
So I used to DJ at the Roxy. There's like this club on top called On the Rocks. So I would do that. I had played like seven or eight shows with a friend there. It was like a stressful situation getting in every time because I wasn't 21 yet. So.
Did they know that?
Yeah, they did, but they would still card me and I couldn't bring friends through really. Like there's one time when I was trying to bring my friend to come see me DJ and they were like, what year did you graduate high school? And she like paused for maybe 30 seconds and I was like, wasn't it 2012? And they were like, oh, okay, you can come in. Like, it was fine. It's like always, you have to deal with that when you're younger.
But even as like a young performer, it's like, I'm the DJ. Wouldn't you just show up early and just do that? Or you just always get carded all
right,
the time?
No, they always like try to card you. I've had situations where I've played a show and I'm of age now, but we were in San Francisco like 2 years ago and they wouldn't let me into the crowd. They were just, they had like a little section for us to hang out in.
And so you then, played and then they're like, you can't go past this area.
And I had friends there too, who were like in the show.
Just like, so would you like stand by the barrier and just kind of like chatter?
Yeah, I was like, hey, what's up? Like, I felt kind of weird about it, to be honest.
And what type of music would you play and how did that evolve from your jazz guitar training into the music that you're making now?
Yeah, so I mean, I played jazz in high school. I also played a lot of rock. So a lot of like the minor pentatonic scales that I was practicing find their way into my music. Like when I solo on my music live, like I'm usually playing like pentatonic stuff because that's what I remember. I'm not really taking guitar lessons now. I've been getting more into like synths and like evolving that side of me more. I even like recently stopped playing guitar like for the new music I'm making.
Well, you have
like,
Ian.
That's yeah, well, I have Ian.
Yeah, that's my purpose.
What would Ian do if you were also playing guitar?
If I wasn't playing guitar?
No, if you were playing guitar, what would Ian be doing?
Ian would just be dancing. Oh, okay. Like naked, probably, yeah. Maybe.
I do that already.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You usually like to rehearse naked, I would say.
Yeah.
Does it free up the creativity?
Yeah. Freedom of body, freedom of mind, freedom of, yeah, place and time.
Yeah.
That's kind of a rhyme.
Definitely. We also like live stream. So we have like a cam show and you can like pay.
Yeah. Well, that's how you fund the project.
Is it okay if we plug that or is it
yeah,
like
of course.
A little inappropriate?
Anyone can plug anything.
Okay. Check out www.beshkincamshow.net. It's $5 for a sub and like a lot of perks.
Can you add on the EP?
Yeah. Def.
Yeah. Yeah. The classic upsell. Yeah.
Sometimes it's we're not even playing.
Yeah, exactly.
We're just playing our music while we dance.
We're entrepreneurs.
Yeah, very much so.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah.
What are you gonna play for us first?
We're gonna play The Roman Call, which is a single off of the last EP that we got. So
great. Here we go live on Snacky Tunes. You talk about how LA, or you used LA to cultivate your identity and ideology. How did that city play into the music you make now?
Yeah, so, I mean, LA is a super diverse city, as, like, a lot of people know. I was really into the lo-fi hip-hop scene that was kind of going on there. A lot of, like, beat makers really influenced me. Guys like Shlomo, the low-end theory scene out there, Daddy Kev, Alpha Pup. But then on the other hand, you have, yeah, you have, like, We Did It, which is, like, more electronic, and then... there's just so much music out in LA. I think for me, it was a place to really find what I enjoyed listening to and actually meet people who were in the scene doing different things. Yeah.
And what was it that shaped your, how did it begin to shape the dance music love and also your identity, which is really interesting?
Right. I would say just a lot of these guys and girls making music out there were really focused on like how they looked in a way, I would say, and kind of their vibe, whether it, like, for example, We Did It, which is a big influence of mine, their whole idea of we're not just a music label, we're also like a fashion line, and we're also making like hip hop, but it's not limited to just that. You can kind of do whatever you want. And so in that kind of way, it was a way for me to be like, I don't have to stick to one thing as a musician. Like, okay, I can make a record that sounds a little more bubbly and light and like happy. And then the next thing I do can be like sad and like the opposite. And it allowed me to kind of get out of that mindset that I have to keep doing the same thing in order to like maintain a good...
Where do you think that mindset came from? Those constraints, or those personal set constraints?
Right. Maybe like, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I think that something that like pushes me or like was holding me back, but at the same time pushing me was like my mom, who would be like, okay, I like the electronic stuff that you're doing, but like play guitar more and like sing and do this. So in that way, I started playing guitar and like singing more, and at the same time it didn't like allow me to like make, I wasn't making decisions for myself, so now I'm kind of opening up a little bit more, I guess.
What brought you to Brooklyn?
School. Yeah, I'm at NYU right now, and I was living in Manhattan. Now I'm in Brooklyn because I'm trying to be a real like Brooklynite. It was always a dream of mine to like live in Brooklyn, you know what I mean? It has that kind of like aura.
How are you balancing school and doing the music full time?
Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard. I'm like, I have to do like homework tonight. So it's not.
I do not envy ever going back. No, I still have I haven't been in college in like 13 years, right. And I still have nightmares about not being ready for a test. And I was like, I've been in school in years.
Right.
It sticks with you.
Yeah, luckily I'm studying music, so I don't have that many tests. It's more production stuff. It's stuff I like doing. So I'm doing mostly music, some like philosophy.
And what is homework in music education?
What is just making music?
You're like, I wrote my new EP.
Yeah. Or it'll be like, write an EP, and I'm like, I wrote an EP. So I don't know.
You're like, can I submit this?
Right. And they're like, well, no, you should do something for this class. And I'm like, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's
sure,
all remixes, sure. And they're just actually demos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Can we hear another song?
Yeah.
So, what are you going to play for us?
Lightning by the Sea.
Tell me when you want me.
When I first reached out to you last year, you were living in Berlin.
This is true.
What took you out there and what were you doing out there?
Yeah, so I was studying abroad there and partying abroad there.
I can imagine.
And clubbing abroad.
Take us through, where did you go?
Taking it in. Oh my gosh. I tried to go to as many different places as I could. I mean, I went to like the main place, like Berghain and like
classic
Tresor. So like saw a lot of techno. I'm really into techno. I've actually been DJing some techno since I've been out here. Under different names.
What's the name?
Pseudonyms. DJ Teen Dad.
DJ Teen Dad?
Teen Dad or DJ 16 and Pregnant. So if you ever see those names,
no,
you know it's me.
You know. What education did you get from being out in Berlin?
Yeah, so there's a lot of like experiential education. Just like pushing my limits, challenging myself.
Can I do also, 72 hours in Panorama Bar?
Yeah,
I don't know.
You?
Can I?
I couldn't, but that's just me. I love the way my voice sounds on this mic, by the way. It's really smooth, soothing.
I didn't know like Molly was a form of education. But I learned, Ben came back and told me, so.
Spiritual.
I gotta try it.
Yeah, you do. But no, I mean, I was taking some like great music classes out there, actually. I was learning a lot about, like, analog synthesis, also, like, more experimental techniques of recording, like, using a lot of, like, field-recorded sounds and doing a lot more with electronic music than what I'm used to in school. Learned about Bitcoin. I had a class on, like, Bitcoin and, like, cryptocurrency and AI. So a lot of future, like, what the future holds, which is something that I'm really interested in, and which is, that's kind of the reason I, like, dropped my guitar. I was like, I'm in Berlin. Like, no one's playing guitar here. Like, I'm just going to make electronic sounds and, like, stuff that, like, hurts my ears. Like, that's fun.
After it was all said and done, did you see a shift in the music that you were making, or what were some of the jumps that you felt in the creative process?
Totally. I mean, I started using more synths, first of all. Like, I've been messing around with the Moog Mother a lot.
Expensive habit. Great.
Oh, very. I don't know if I'm ready to get into analog synthesis, because I know I'm going to have to drop at least $5,000 to really, like, start doing it. But I would love to. It's so cool. So, like, it works your brain in a different way than I think using a computer does, or using, like, playing an instrument. It's totally, like, it's more like, I want to say, like, electrical engineering in a way.
Do you feel your education upbringing in jazz theory plays into the analog synths in the way that it... you can write music on it?
Honestly, not really. Not, because it's like, if you're using something like a Moog Mother, it's like one note, right? That you're like sequencing a bunch. So at that point, you're kind of just using your ears to like adjust resonance and like frequencies. And it's less, for me, theoretical and more like intuitive, trusting myself.
So between synth education, going to class, you have a show this weekend elsewhere.
Yes.
Who are you playing with? When are you playing?
Yeah, I'm playing... So the show starts at 8, goes to like 11. Playing with this band, Blood Culture. It's a really cool band out here. And this really cool producer, Jackie Mendoza. So it should be a great show. I actually just played with her out in L.A., and we might start playing a few more shows together out here.
And they let you right in through the front door. 21... Show me your ID.
Yeah, I'm fine now.
No barriers. Have a drink.
Zero barrier. I mean, yeah, I've been drinking a lot. Like, it's good. It's good. I'm sure, like, some people who are listening to this are like, who the fuck is this kid?
We were all 21 and in Berlin once.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, most of us.
I hope so.
I mean, I'm 20. I've never been to Berlin, so.
Okay. Well, you have time.
Yeah, true.
It's an exodus. So you have to take it.
You have to put in the time there.
That's exactly. True.
I want to make sure we get time for one more song. Mm-hmm. Where can people find you, get your EP, find out about shows?
Yeah. I mean, if you use SoundCloud, go to SoundCloud, go by Beshkin, or Spotify. Both are really good places to find music nowadays. I don't really use Bandcamp that much, but you can find my music on Bandcamp. If you want to pay for it, that'd be cool, but I don't really care that much.
Bandcamp has been really good to artists.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. They haven't been, like, super good to me.
Oh.
But in general, you're right.
In general, right. Well, I want to thank Billy and Ariel coming on, and Ben and Ian for coming by. Thanks for listening. We will be back with an all-new episode of Snacky Tunes next week. What are you going to take us out with?
I'm going to take you out with a song called Secrets off my first EP.
So, yeah. Secrets.
Don't ruin the secret.
Thanks for listening. Here we go.
Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/sub.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.
Subscribe.